Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, we're told to eat plenty of fruits and vegetables in order to stay healthy. But what about the toll it takes on the health of the workers who pick those foods? We'll talk with Dr. Seth Holmes, the author of a new book called Fresh Fruits, Broken Bodies. We'll also hear a report from FM89's Rebecca Plevin about the steps some large ag employers are taking to provide health care for their workers outside of the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. And we'll talk about Fresno's homeless situation as the city today continues to clear a number of unauthorized homeless encampments near downtown. It's a move that has many homeless advocates crying foul. We'll talk to some people with a different idea and learn how another city has taken an innovative approach to dealing with the homeless population. That and more on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
I'm Ezra Romero with these news headlines. The California legislature enters its home stretch today. Lawmakers have just 2 weeks left to debate hundreds of bills. Ben Adler reports from Sacramento on some of the major issues still on the table.
It's finally the time of year when committee hearings come to an end and all-day floor sessions begin, day after day, until lawmakers adjourn at the end of next week. But they've got some big issues to tackle first, and none bigger than prisons. Two competing plans propose different ways of responding to a federal court order requiring the state to reduce overcrowding in its prisons. Other bills, the fates of which are still up in the air, include fracking regulations, a minimum wage increase, several gun and ammunition control measures, and changes to the California Environmental Quality Act. And there's always the chance that brand new bills will emerge out of thin air at the 11th hour through the process known as gut and amend. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
The California Budget Project's annual Labor Day report shows most workers aren't benefiting from the economic recovery. As Max Pringle reports from Sacramento, it says the state may not reach the employment levels it saw before the Great Recession for another 2 years.
California's recovery continues to show some long-term employment patterns.
Some of these trends have actually been going on for a while, especially wage stagnation for low and mid-wage earners.
That's Luke Riedenbach with the California Budget Project, the left-leaning think tank that authored the study. He says low-wage jobs have been outpacing middle-class jobs for a while, and the Great Recession made it worse.
Teachers, librarians, social workers, and construction workers have continually seen employment declines during both the recession and during the recovery.
The report says recent cuts in services to unemployed and low-income Californians are also contributing to income inequality. At the state capitol, I'm Max Pringle.
California's new health insurance marketplace will start advertising through TV commercials this week. Healthcare reporter Pauline Bartolone in Sacramento has more on the choice of messaging.
One of the covered California ads features images of road signs and shows a family driving down the California coastline with smiles on their faces and wind in their hair.
Soon, Californians from Sacramento to Salinas to San Diego will have equal access to quality health insurance. Those who need financial assistance will get it. And nobody will be denied because of a pre-existing condition.
The Spanish language commercial shows people opening doors to their houses and workplaces. Dana Howard of Covered California says the goal is to make viewers feel welcome to buy health insurance under the federal health law.
And assure them that this is going to deliver them a new state of peace of mind.
The first two ads will air in select markets, but later this fall, different ads will take on a more serious tone, highlighting incidents of injury and illness.
The feeling of that it won't happen to me is more prevalent among younger people, and we most certainly do want and need younger people to enroll in Covered California. But the messaging is to everyone.
Open enrollment for Covered California starts October 1st for health coverage beginning in January. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
Firefighters are making progress battling the Rim Fire in and near Yosemite National Park. While the fire has now grown to over 235,000 acres, officials with CAL FIRE are reporting that the blaze is now 75% contained. The fire is now the fourth largest in California history. Officials say the fire should be fully contained by September 20th. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Much of our program today has to do with work. That's somewhat fitting, with yesterday being Labor Day, after all. Later in our show, we'll talk about the toll that farm labor takes on the bodies of those who pick our food, the same food that we're told to eat in order to stay healthy. Dr. Seth Holmes, a medical anthropologist at UC Berkeley and the author of the new book, Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, will join the conversation. We'll also hear a report about how local ag companies are finding innovative ways to bring health care to their workers. And we'll talk about those without jobs, the homeless. We'll look at some alternative solutions to the homeless encampments the city of Fresno is currently working to clear. But first, an update to a story we told you about 6 months ago, also involving farm laborers. You may recall the tragedy of the plane crash at Los Gatos Canyon near Coalinga in western Fresno County back in 1948. All on board the DC-3, chartered by the U.S. Immigration Service, died in the accident. National newspapers famously reported the names of the flight crew and an immigration officer, but referred to the passengers simply as 28 Mexican deportees. And for decades, they remained nameless, buried in a mass grave here in Fresno. They weren't completely forgotten, though. Their memory was kept alive in a famous Woody Guthrie song, which had assigned them symbolic names. And earlier this year, a local author and clergy banded together to finally bring closure to this story and reunite those who died with their names. FM89's Rebecca Plevin brings us this story from a memorial service held in their honor on Labor Day.
Hundreds of people gathered at Holy Cross Cemetery in Fresno on Monday to remember the victims of a plane crash that occurred 65 years ago. Among them was Jaime Ramirez of Fresno, whose relatives died in the accident.
My grandfather, Ramon Paredes Gonzalez, also my great-uncle, Guadalupe Ramirez Lara.
They worked in the fields of California as braceros, or guest workers, and as undocumented workers. They were being deported back to Mexico when the plane's wing caught fire and broke off.
Back in Mexico, we didn't have no details of the accident, no address of where they were buried, nothing. All we have is just a few information, and they got it through a newspaper. Officially, they never receive anything.
For years, Ramirez's relatives were buried at Holy Cross below a small, nameless headstone. But on Monday morning, Ramirez crouched down in the cemetery and held the corner of a colorful serape, or Mexican blanket, in his hand. Then he helped reveal a large new granite memorial that lists the names of his relatives and the other crash victims. The memorial is engraved with a border of 32 leaves, one for each passenger.
It's very emotional for me and my family, and it's like a puzzle, you know, putting the pieces together. And I think today we did it. We finally put together the puzzle.
Author Tim Z. Hernandez spearheaded the effort to recognize the crash victims. He researched their names and located some of their descendants. He worked with the Diocese of Fresno to raise thousands of dollars for the new headstone. The project is part of a book he's working on about the crash. For him, the unveiling of the headstone was unforgettable.
We just kind of stood there looking at it for a little while. It was just like I just felt overcome with emotion that I had to take a knee and just kind of embrace it. That's what I wanted to do, was just be close to it. And then I was saying thank you to all the lives there, because just for letting me be a small part of this.
During the ceremony, musicians Lance Canales and Jem Bluestein stood on a stage above the new memorial and sang a haunting version of Guthrie's song, Deportee. But this time, it was no longer necessary to call the victims by symbolic names. Hernandez and Ramirez read the names of the 28 Mexican nationals during the song's musical interludes. After each name, audience members spontaneously called out Descanse en Paz, Spanish for Rest in Peace.
Guadalupe Ramirez Lara.
Descanse en Paz.
Alberto Carlos Raigosa.
Descanse en Paz.
Folk singer John McCutcheon also sang a version of Deportee during the ceremony. The song has always reminded Connie Ann Mart of Marin County of her uncle, Frank Atkinson. He was the pilot of the plane, and his wife, Bobby, was a stewardess.
This happened almost 8 months to the day before I was born. But it was still such a tragedy to the family. that I was aware and told about him, and he was just in my life all my life, especially in my younger years.
For Mart, the ceremony brought a sense of closure to the tragedy.
It's such a completion. It's they're all together now in my mind.
That's a sentiment that Tim Hernandez shared with the audience.
It's not every day that we get to witness or take part in a closure of this capacity.
He told the crowd that the ceremony demonstrated how one tragedy affected the lives of so many people.
Since that song has been recorded, this history, this incident, has been one-sided, mostly known and shared among folk music circles all across the world. But now we know the other side to the story. Now we know who the people are behind the nameless. Now we know who their lives are.
He's still searching for the families of the 26 other Mexican nationals who died in the crash. He wants to include their stories in his upcoming book.
And so I invite you to share the story now. Go far and wide and share it everywhere, because the more we share the story, then the more we all participate in correcting the past.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
You're listening to Valley Edition. This morning, work crews from the city of Fresno are beginning to clear another homeless encampment near downtown. It's a familiar process that's been repeated many times over the past few years. The city has ordered those who live in the camps to pack up their belongings and move along by a certain date. While dozens of homeless individuals have been placed into transitional housing through the efforts of the city and the housing authority, for most, they have no place to go, and similar camps simply reemerge at a later date. The city has said the camps are a threat to public health and safety. Homeless advocates say there has to be a better solution. Joining us now, we have two local homeless advocates with us in the studio, Bill Simon with the John Steinbach Homeless Advisory Committee and Beverly Fitzpatrick with the Thursday Group. Bill and Beverly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And I should add that we invited representatives from the city of Fresno to join us this morning, but they were unavailable. We are also joined in the studio by local architect Arthur Dyson, who has been working on some creative solutions to this issue for a number of years. Art, welcome.
Thank you.
And I want to start with you, Bill. Tell me about the process of clearing the camps that started last week. Is this any different than the prior efforts that previous city administrations have undertaken, some of which even led to lawsuits over the destruction of homeless property?
Well, the city seems to have learned some lessons in that I didn't see them destroying property like they have in the past. We all agreed, as of last week, there wasn't any reason for lawsuits. So maybe they've at least become legal. But all those people have no place to go.
Beverly, your thoughts on the clearing of the encampments that began last week?
I think that's my frustration, is where are the people going to go? Because right now they're just wandering around the streets, and the task force has been told to, the city task force has been told to have them move along, that they can't stay in one place for a long time. I actually heard a homeless person told me that they were told that they can walk around the city during the daytime with their shopping cart or their belongings, and they could sleep at night, but then they have to move on.
That's one of the things that really upsets me lately. In Long Beach, the police department appointed two police officers back in 2007, I think it was, to work exclusively with the homeless to get them into housing. And there was one story of one officer who worked with one person for a year to get him into housing. But it worked. Fresno, now we have a task force of one sergeant, four police officers, two code enforcement officers, and two sanitation workers to make sure nobody sleeps in the same place over two nights in a row. That doesn't help.
How do you feel that this current effort aligns with the city's stated goal, the 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness? The city has adopted this housing-first strategy. There have been some efforts along those lines in terms of providing transitional housing or homeless housing. The Renaissance Santa Clara opened in November of 2012, 69 units at a cost of some $12 million. It would take quite a bit more money to house the
what is it, 4,000 to 6,000 homeless individuals that most accounts estimate live on the streets. How do you feel that this current clearing of the camps fits in with that strategy? Does it?
It seems to me that the city is just trying to convince the people to go somewhere else, leave Fresno altogether. In fact, somebody from the city said that in the last few days.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And, you know, the other thing is that a lot of the issues that happen in the encampments at night or whenever, we don't even have an emergency shelter in this community. I realize Omaha, Nebraska they're a very good example, but they have 4 emergency shelters for overnight sleeping. And I think that's something that if we had that, some of the problems in the encampment would be lessened because there would be a place to stay overnight and then leave in the morning. And they also would be able to acquire some services there, too, if they needed to.
And the problems you're speaking of, Chief Jerry Dyer has been very public in talking about the fact that it's his belief that the encampments have become home to a number of criminal activities and other things, drug dealing, and there have also been a number of fires and other things in recent weeks in those encampments. I heard one homeless advocate say that by dispersing these individuals from the camps, it actually makes it harder to provide them services because they go out throughout the community. Bill, is that the case?
That is certainly the case. I was just thinking that. When they closed the encampments in 2011, somebody from FHA called me and said, "We're ready to put all these people in housing, but we can't find them anymore. Can you help us find them?" If people are not in a stable place, there is no way to do anything for them because it takes months and months of talking with someone before they might be ready to get into a rehab program or even be ready to move into housing. It can take a year to convince somebody they want to get into an apartment. And if you can't find them, you can't help them with that.
Well, I guess this whole discussion asks the question, what's next? What's the alternative? And joining us on the telephone now, we have Scott Lehman. He's the building coordinator and tour guide for Dignity Village in Portland, Oregon. This is a facility that's been cited as an example for many communities who are searching for a new approach to homeless issues in their community. Scott, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing very well. How has your experience in Portland been with Dignity Village, essentially a sanctioned official, for lack of a better term, campground? What has your experience been like there?
It's been great for me and my wife. It's been great. It certainly saved our relationship and has given us a place to be, and we've both got part-time jobs and are moving forward, ready to get back into mainstream society.
What was that transition like for you? Did it take something like this rather than another type of transitional housing program that you feel might not have worked in your case? I take it you were living on the streets before Dignity Village?
Yes, we were. The thing about Dignity Village is it's homeless people helping homeless people. We help each other get cleaned up, get whatever we need, like IDs and stuff, and then just kind of build each other up to get jobs and get back out there.
Go ahead. For our listeners who aren't familiar with what Dignity Village is like, can you describe it? How does it differ from a homeless encampment that you might have lived in previously in Portland or anywhere else?
Well, my wife and I, we camped in the woods. We camped by ourselves and in the woods before we found the village. The village is great. It's a bunch of single homes. It's like 43 structures that people live in. And, it's an open area. It's like a community. It's like an intentional community.
Fascinating. I want to bring architect Arthur Dyson into the conversation now. You've been working with some students and other community advocates on this concept of an eco-village to do something similar to what Portland has done, but with its own unique twist here for our own unique needs here in the Valley. How did your idea for the eco-village come about, Art?
Well, it came about, I think, in an effort to try to house folks. And I think everyone around this table is all for the Housing First program. But we need a bridge. That's what we lack between those right now that are homeless and those that will be placed in homes. We don't have that. What we're doing is chasing folks around. And these aren't criminals. And you mentioned that there, Chief Dyer had said that there is criminal activity in the area and a number of things happening. That same thing happens in other areas of the city. But you don't throw everybody in the city out of that area. You take care of the crime. That hasn't happened here.
So what was your specific proposal?
What we're trying to do is look at a new paradigm, look at the cycle that exists and see how we can break that, how we can build a bridge to the future for folks, probably our most vulnerable citizens. And it's to put them in a different setting and to also give them the tools that they need to help move them forward. It doesn't help to take folks, give them a voucher for 6 months, and then put them back on the streets again with no other tools. So what we're trying to do is create a setting that's a holistic setting, a setting within a natural environment, a setting that has landscape and trees and plants and gardens that they can work in and they can produce some of the food that they'll eat. And then also have guidance from psychologists and urban anthropologists and sociologists and economic advisors and other people that will, again, give them the tools that they need to get them back in society.
What would it take to make this concept a reality? How much land? How much money?
Well, you know, it's such a huge problem. You mentioned 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 folks. We're also hearing estimates up to 20,000 in Fresno County. So, you know, it's a nebulous figure. There are a lot of invisible folks out there. Also, understand that it's estimated that a third of the homeless folks are unattended children in the community. That's a frightening thing. Those folks usually aren't seen, but it's part of that community.
Certainly. So what would your project, again, for our listeners, we don't have the benefits of visuals here today, but could you describe what the eco-village would be like?
Well, the concept of an eco-village would have several parts to it. Number one, it would have living units, but the living units would be more than a storage shed. It would be something that's uplifting. It would not just provide protection from the elements, but also uplift the spirit. I think that's really important. It would be a co-housing type of a development where there would be shared bath facilities, kitchen, dining areas, laundry areas. And then the third component of that would be an economic driver so that folks, for instance, that could do woodworking skills might accept donated used furniture and reupholster it and refinish it and put it back on the market. There might be folks building solar chimneys for adaption throughout the community. There might be folks that propagate and grow and harvest bamboo, a number of different industries that people could be trained in and worked on. And what happens is that a homeless person can't even fill out a job application because they don't have an address. This would give folks an address. This is a temporary type of a bridge, maybe for a year. At the end of this time, folks would have money in their pockets. They would have training. They would have an employment resume and an address. The concept is if they make products, they sell them, maybe a third of that money would go into their pocket, a third would go into running the center, and a third would go into a savings account that they could access when they leave. So when they're leaving, they have some savings with them, they have some skills, and they can move forward.
This sounds like a type of project that would need some buy-in from local elected officials and folks. How has the reception been?
It's been mixed. Some of it's been very encouraging. Some of it hasn't. There's some very creative folks in the city and county that are coming forward and I think going to be working with us. We're working on a project right now with the city to develop one of these units. We're also going to have partners in this. Probably Tree Fresno to landscape the areas, possibly the Master Gardeners of Fresno to help with gardening, with Fresno State, Fresno Pacific University for resources, human resources to help for guidance with folks. It's really interesting in that homeless people usually live in the most toxic environment possible for the conditions that they're in. They live next to a railroad track, a freeway. They have noise pollution. They have air pollution. Studies have told us, shown things that we've known anecdotally over the years, but we now have backing of these through the Neuroscience Institute in San Diego, that someone living within a natural environment that are surrounded by plants, the incidence of violence and aggression decreases almost 15-fold within that type of an environment. So that's the kind of an environment that we're trying to build for folks. And a part of this would be working with the homeless community to help build this.
Before we go, we just have a few minutes left. Art, what about the cost of this project, the Renaissance of Santa Clara? I worked out on the back of my napkin here, $173,000 per unit per individual, essentially. Is that comparable to what you're looking at? Is your solution cheaper, more expensive?
Not quite comparable. We're looking at maybe $4,000 a unit.
It was said with true deadpan humor. We're talking about the current situation in Fresno with the clearing of the homeless camps. And I want to bring Scott Lehman back on the phone from Portland for one last comment. Scott, one of the issues in many of these encampments, at least here in California, is security. And what is the environment like in Portland? Is this a safe place? Is it a clean place? Can you describe that for us, if you may?
One of our major rules is no drugs or alcohol allowed on the premise. And we do have security 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We are determined the safest neighborhood in Portland.
That's great news, and congratulations on getting your life back in great order and a new direction for you. It's very exciting. Bill and Beverly, before we go, I want to get your last thoughts. Is this going to be any different this time with what the city is doing? Is it going to turn out any differently? Are these camps that's going to pop up again a mile away somewhere else?
I would hope that they pop up again a mile away somewhere else. But the city says they're not going to let that happen, which means we're going to have people walking up and down the streets in our neighborhoods all day and all night. It's going to be a much worse situation. Every time the city closes an encampment, the standard of living for the homeless goes down.
And Beverly, your thoughts. The conditions in the camps, I think everyone would agree, are intolerable. There are genuine concerns about public health and things like that. How do you see this working out right now with the current plan announced by City Manager Bruce Redd?
Well, right now it's very, very difficult for everyone. But I want people to know that they can go to helpfresnoshomeless.org and they can read a great proposal about safe and legal campgrounds so that we can get that going right now. And it's written in phases, so it shows how the city and the volunteers can work together. When I was at city council last week, I proposed that we work together. We're here to help our homeless. I've been working with them for 2 years, and I would like all of us to work together, including the city.
Great. We've been talking with Beverly Fitzpatrick from the Thursday Group and Bill Simon from the John Steinbach Homeless and Memorial Advisory Committee. Also with architect Art Dyson, the visionary behind the concept of the Eco Village here in Fresno, talking about solutions to the homeless problem. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment and learn more about what farm employers are doing to bring health care to their workers. That's coming up in just a moment on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We continue our program now with a look at the health of those who pick our food and provide the labor that makes California's Central Valley, our billion-dollar agriculture economy, possible. Farm workers. In a moment, we'll talk with Dr. Seth Holmes. He's a medical anthropologist at UC Berkeley who's written a new book called Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies. He spent 2 summers as a farm worker in Washington State and here in Madera County doing firsthand research about the toll that field work takes on the bodies of ag laborers. But first, we look at access to health care. Experts estimate that in California, 4 out of every 5 farm workers are uninsured. And for a variety of reasons, They expect relatively few farm workers to benefit from the expansion of coverage under Obamacare. But there are some signs that may be changing. FM89's Rebecca Plevin reports on how two large agricultural employers in the Central Valley have developed innovative ways to provide access to health care for their employees.
It's late summer and the almond harvest is well underway in Madera County. Along a tree-lined country road, about a dozen AgriLand employees are transferring almonds into a huge elevator.
These guys are dumping into the belt, into the elevator, uh-huh. And then throwing into the trucks.
The nuts will then be loaded into a truck. They will appear on the shelves as Blue Diamond brand almonds. As a company of 175 employees, AgriLand is considered a large business under the Affordable Care Act. Beginning in January 2015, the company will be required to offer affordable, high-quality health insurance to its workers or pay a fine. The company's obligation is to offer insurance. It's the employee's choice to accept it or not. The company will comply with the law, but CEO Jim Maxwell is concerned that many of his low-wage workers can't afford to buy into a traditional health insurance program.
So at the end of the day, we've complied with the act, but our employees haven't moved forward in terms of the quality of the health care that they're receiving.
So the company has also established a partnership with a local community health center. While it's not insurance coverage, the partnership will improve employees' access to preventative and primary health care.
So we tried to design a plan that would be responsive to their needs.
In the face of the Affordable Care Act, many large agricultural companies are facing a similar quandary. The challenge is to develop a health program that complies with a federal health law that's both affordable to growers and beneficial to their workers. Joel Derringer is a health policy consultant in San Luis Obispo.
There was great opportunity for the Affordable Care Act to provide extended coverage to farm workers. The reality is that very few will actually obtain benefits under the Affordable Care Act.
The main reason, he says, is that many farm workers are undocumented and unable to receive benefits through the expanded Medi-Cal program or the state's health insurance exchange, Covered California. Another reason is many ag employees are part-time seasonal workers, but the law requires large businesses to offer insurance only to full-time employees. And even if they do qualify for coverage, farm workers may struggle to afford it. That's why some ag employers in the Central Valley are finding creative ways to comply with the law and provide their workers with access to care.
While the farm workers are not going to get the full coverage that we had hoped for under the ACA, the ag industry is looking at innovative ways for providing health services for their workers. And the reasons that they're doing that is that they need a healthy and stable workforce. And it may not be through the traditional full-scope insurance, but maybe one that really focuses on preventive and primary care.
Some of those new models include establishing a relationship with an existing clinic like AgriLand has done, or setting up their own health clinic as Paramount Citrus recently did. If you've driven along Highway 99 in Kern County, you've no doubt seen the new Paramount Citrus facilities in Delano. Less visible from the road, though, is the company's new on-site health center. Danny Garcia, the company's director of human resources, walks through the citrus-colored clinic.
We have two exam rooms and one lab, and then office space for the health and wellness coach and for the office space for the providers.
The company has a contract with Kaiser Permanente, which operates the clinic. All Paramount Citrus employees and their families can receive primary care services like well baby screenings, immunizations, and diabetes tests. Paramount Citrus also offers health insurance to its workers, and the company says 75% of their employees buy into the program. But the health center is free to all employees, regardless of whether they are insured. Paramount Citrus is owned by Stuart and Linda Resnick. David Krause is the company president.
There's a real belief, again, with the owners that preventative health care is the right approach. So by making it available, our hope is that we'll catch things earlier, keep people healthier, obviously keep them at work and happy much more than having to deal with the sickness or the illness after the fact.
Krauss says the partnership between Paramount and Kaiser is groundbreaking.
There's a significant cost associated with this. If it wasn't for the vision of our owners and their willingness to put that, you know, cost aside and provide this benefit, it would be hard to justify. We think that this is a long-term investment in the health and well-being of our employees and their families.
Almost 100 miles north on the 99, AgriLand CEO Jim Maxwell says he will offer health insurance to all his employees. But he expects most of his low-wage workers to opt out of the insurance program.
If you look at the Affordable Health Care Act, it's not affordable to our employees.
So the company is partnering with Camarena Health, the federally qualified health center in Madera County, to provide health care to its employees. The health and wellness program is available to all employees, whether or not they participate in the company's insurance program. The company pays for 80% of an employee's health care costs at Camarena Clinics, and the employee is responsible for the remaining 20%.
We are trying to design a program with the help of our employees that meets their health needs at a cost that we can all afford.
Maxwell believes his plan could become a model for keeping farm workers healthy.
If we can sort of work the bugs out of it, then yes, we very much hope that it would be a model for others so that more and more people could have access to the things that they really need to stay healthy.
As the federal health law looms, other ag companies might consider these multi-pronged approaches to offering insurance and health care to their employees. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And Rebecca joins us now in our studio to tell us a little more about this situation. You've talked to a lot of people in the insurance world, experts in the healthcare law. What are they saying about this two-pronged approach? Because it's really not what was envisioned under the law, but it seems to be working, at least for these employers.
Right. So it was not what was envisioned under the law, but like we mentioned in the story, there are some challenges to offering traditional insurance to lower-wage farm workers and field workers and ag employees. So what I'm hearing from insurance experts is that they think that this two-pronged approach might work with the law. It might comply with the employer's responsibility to offer care, and then it'll comply with the need to offer care, but then they will also be making sure that their employees actually have access to health care. It won't be insurance. If there's a catastrophic accident, it won't be insurance, but they will have access to care.
Now, how does this fit with the individual mandate? We've all been told that everyone has to have insurance as of January 1st. People can enroll. If they don't get it through their employer, they can enroll in Covered California, Medi-Cal. Why not that for these individuals?
Right, and that's what makes this whole situation a little sticky, is that it's estimated that two-thirds of farm workers in California are undocumented, and the undocumented are not subject to the individual mandate, so they don't have to have health insurance.
And they don't have to pay a fine then either.
That's right.
Interesting. Well, this is certainly a story we will continue to follow, and it's one of those that's intertwined so closely with the immigration debate and things like that. So thank you so much for bringing us that report, Rebecca.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. As the House and Senate continue to struggle to find common ground on the issue of immigration reform, one UC Berkeley professor is working to bring us new insights into a significant group of undocumented immigrants here in California and throughout the West, those who pick the food we eat every day. To do so, medical anthropologist Dr. Seth Holmes did something that few others in his profession or the media have done. He became a farm worker himself. For 2 years, he spent summers working with treacle farm workers in Washington State and here in Madera County. He later moved to Oaxaca in Mexico and lived with the workers there, all the while documenting the physical toll that farm labor took on their bodies. He recounts his story and those of the people he worked with in his new book called Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. He joins us today from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Dr. Holmes, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
How did the idea of taking up residence with the farm workers and becoming one yourself, how did you come up with that idea?
As an anthropologist, the kind of research method that I use is often called participant observation. So unlike most research where people would do just interviews or surveys, that would fall under the observation category. As an anthropologist, I also want to participate in the life of the people who I'm trying to understand. And so in order to do that, to understand U.S.-Mexico migration, I really needed to migrate from the U.S. to Mexico and back. And in the process, I lived in labor camps, picked berries in Washington State, lived in an apartment that was bad enough conditions in order to rent to people who don't have a credit history, and pruned vineyards and did other work when it was available, and then went down to their home village in Oaxaca, the state of Oaxaca in southern Mexico, and then crossed the border back into the U.S. We were actually apprehended by the Border Patrol during that crossing in the desert, and then back to Madera and back to Washington again. That was 18 months full-time in the mid-2000s, and then since then I've gone back and visited each of these sites once or twice a year, most years.
And I want to talk about the toll on health in a moment, but first, how did you actually first enter this world? Was that a challenge in and of itself? And what was that like, that first immersion into the world of farm labor and with the tricky farm workers from Mexico?
I think most anthropologists and probably reporters would tell similar stories of how they gained access to their research site. Mine was somewhat serendipitous. After a fair amount of time trying to find a way to live with and work with farm workers and get to know them, I happened upon the Skagit Valley of Washington State, where my next-door neighbor from childhood had become a Methodist minister, and a backpacking guide I used to work with had become a social worker there with undocumented Treaty people. And so the minister introduced me to the farm owner who went to her church, and the social worker introduced me to some of the pickers, and that's sort of how it started. After 5 months living on the farm and picking berries up in Washington State, I moved with an extended family, maybe 7 different cars full of people from Oaxaca, from the indigenous group Treaty, down to Madera, California. And the first week we lived out of our cars and used the bathrooms in the city parks before they closed at dusk. And then eventually we found an apartment that would rent to us, despite the fact that none of them had bank accounts or credit cards.
Were you at all prepared for the grueling physical nature of the work?
Not at all. I picked 1 or 2 days a week, and in Washington State, the Treaty people picked 7 days a week. In California, by law, people, farm workers work 6 days a week, which was usually followed, although not always. And the days that I picked, I had knee pain and back pain and hip pain, and my hands would get stained the color of whatever we were picking, strawberries or whatever it was. And then I would kind of recover over the next days while doing interviews of doctors and nurses and farm owners and farm workers and supervisors and other people, whereas the people I worked with did that every single day. So it definitely put the question in my mind, partially about the distinction between skilled labor and unskilled labor, because I was never able to keep up with the farm workers. I worked as hard as I could. I got myself to focus as much as I could. I learned how to pick berries and pop the tops off the berries with each hand. At the same time, I always fell behind. So definitely in that context, I was the unskilled labor and they were very skilled. But in our society, that's not usually how we think about what counts as skill and what doesn't.
Tell us a little more about the people you worked with. Who are the Treaty people as a group? And then maybe about some of the individuals that you worked with.
Sure. The Treaty people are an indigenous group native to southern Mexico from the state of Oaxaca. They live, by and large, up in the mountains of Oaxaca, speak their own language, the Treaty language, which is a tonal language, totally unrelated to Romance languages, Spanish, etc. And by and large, they started migrating to the U.S., over the last 10 to 20 years, and it looks like most of that was in response to international economic changes after things like the North American Free Trade Agreement, which made it harder for them as farmers themselves to survive on their own farms in southern Mexico. So until 10 to 20 years ago, they were all, they had oxen and goats and were growing corn and beans, harvesting those and selling whatever they didn't need to eat in nearby towns in order to pay electricity bills or buy uniforms for the public schools in order for their kids to be able to go to school. But after things like the North American Free Trade Agreement, certain economic shifts happened such that they weren't able to survive. Their corn and beans were being undersold by U.S. corn and beans grown on much larger corporate farms, such that in the end, many of them have decided that they needed to migrate to the U.S. to work on our farms in order to survive and in order to send money back to their families so they could continue living there.
Were there any people that stood out that you met, any friendships that developed there, individuals that you might, and stories you might recount with our listeners?
Yes. First, I'd like to say that one of the things I try to do in the book is tell a fair amount of the stories of individuals, because I found the policy debates about immigration reform and immigrants to be relatively devoid of stories of real people. The policy debates often deal with blanket statements about immigrants. Immigrants do this or deserve this or don't deserve that. In the book, one of the people I read about is Samuel. There are some photos of him in the book. He came to the U.S. from San Miguel, which is one of the towns that the Triqui people live in. He came with his wife and son. And I met him when I first started my research in 2003, and then most recently saw him earlier this summer. He's still in the Central Valley of California. He worked on the farms up in Washington State and then came down to Madera County and prune vineyards when there was work available, back and forth for years. And then his family has decided to settle primarily in Madera County for two reasons. One, that crossing the border from Mexico to the U.S. has become more and more dangerous, so it's not possible for him anymore to go home to his hometown to be where his father is and his sister in his ancestral land, so now he's staying in the U.S. The other reason is that he was feeling bad that his son kept getting uprooted from schools. And he really wanted his son to be able to keep up in school and get an education. The last time I visited him, he had just started being able to walk again after being run over by a farm truck last fall in 2012. So he has ongoing stories of suffering and injury related to the work that he does in order to provide us with quality fresh fruit, you know, that we can buy in farmers markets or grocery stores, etc.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, we're talking with medical anthropologist Dr. Seth Holmes from UC Berkeley. He's the author of a new book called Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. And he spent 2 years working as a farm worker with Triqui farm workers in Washington State, two summers, and has checked in with those individuals and kept in touch with them ever since. And as a physician, I want to talk to you a little more about the challenges that these folks face. You mentioned the gentleman who was run over by the farm truck. But beyond accidents like that, just the individual toll on individuals' health and doing this type of labor has to be quite significant. What did you see when someone got hurt, when someone got sick? Where did they go? What did they turn to? Was there a clinic that they went to, and what was that like from your perspective?
Good questions, Joe. Part of the reason I named the book Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, it was an idea that came out of a conversation with another medical anthropologist, Philippe Bourgois, but the name drives home that there's an exchange of the health of farm workers whose bodies become injured and sick through the hard work that they're doing in pesticides and just bent over with their bodies in exchange for our health, those of us who can buy fresh fruit and vegetables that physicians and public health officials and nurses tell us we need to be eating in order to be healthy. So these people, farm workers, are in a sense, by necessity, sacrificing their own health and their own bodies so that the rest of us can be healthy. The most common health problems that I saw during my research involved injuries, occupational health problems, so chronic back pain, chronic knee pain, knee injuries. Statistically, farm workers have an occupational fatality rate, so death rate due to their work, 5 times higher than the rest of workers in the United States, which is very telling. The injury rate is also much higher than the average worker in the U.S. And these people, to this time, have relatively poor access to health care. There are, in different areas in Washington State and in Madera County, there are migrant health clinics that have gotten grants from the federal government in order to take care of migrant and seasonal farm workers. They're generally under the rubric of federally qualified health centers, so they usually have a sliding scale fee, and they have physicians and nurses who take care of people. They often have bilingual staff. But the system isn't perfect in terms of access to hospitals' ability to pay when they do need to have different kinds of treatment, to the point where a lot of farm workers avoid healthcare and avoid physicians and hospitals because they know that even with a sliding scale, the fees that they'll have to pay are higher than they'll likely be able to.
And of course, in most cases, for most farm workers who are undocumented, the reforms with the Affordable Care Act don't apply, and the money that counties and the state have spent on a lot of those programs are being shifted towards the Affordable Care Act to some degree. What are you seeing in terms of the ability for these individuals to maintain access to what limited care they have right now?
Good point, Joe. So the Affordable Care Act in many ways is laudable, extending healthcare access to many people who haven't been able to have it before. But as you point out, there aren't any provisions for immigrants at this time. So though access overall will go up, the disparity between access for most people and access for immigrants will increase. Immigrants might actually have less access in the future. We're not really sure exactly what that will look like, but there definitely are not provisions for them. Interestingly, in the House of Representatives, immigration reform has been stalled. And one of the reasons that I've seen for the stalling is discussion by different representatives of healthcare access. Specifically, some representatives have said that they will not vote for immigration reform unless there's a guarantee that newly legalizing immigrants will not have access to health care for roughly 15 years, despite paying full taxes. And in my research, seeing that the rest of us are able to eat healthy food and become healthy partially due to the bodily work sacrifice of farm workers, this seems unfair to me, and it looks like this group of people deserve healthcare access for their own health while they're helping us, you know, support our own bodies.
When you were working in the fields alongside these migrant workers, were you working for farmers individually? Were you working for labor contractors? How did that work? What was that dynamic like?
Also a good question. There's a difference in my experience and my research between California and several other states. So in Washington State, all of us, all the Treaty farm workers and myself, all of us were hired by the farm. So each of us had a, you know, employee number. Each of us got a check. We had all the state taxes and Social Security taxes and local taxes taken out of our checks. And we were all paid at least minimum wage, partially because there was this paper trail that could be followed. In California, every time we had work, which was not consistent, we were hired by a labor contractor. And during my research, the farm owners would in California would hire a labor contractor to pick a certain number of fields for a certain amount of money. You know, pick these 30 acres for $5,000 or something like that. And then the contractor would need to go find pickers to come work for them for 2 days or 5 days or however long it would be, but there was no paper trail beyond the contractor. So the contractor had an employee number and got checks from the farmer, but the pickers did not. They got paid by the contractor. And every time that we picked in California, we were always paid under the minimum wage. And I think part of the reason is that there was not a paper trail that could be followed. We also in California had to ride a van that was determined by the labor contractor, often one of their friends or someone in their family or something like that. And each day we would have to pay a certain amount, $5, $10, in order to ride in that van instead of us driving our own cars and carpooling and saving money. So it was definitely less lucrative and felt less fair and less legal, in a sense, the way the workers were treated in California.
As a physician who's looking at the issues of the long-term health toll that this type of work takes on these farm workers, you've been in touch with these people for now a decade in some cases. What have you seen in their stories? This is the type of work that takes a lot out of individuals. They aren't able to do it for the types of careers that white-collar workers have in the workforce. What did you see in the people that you followed? How have they changed? How has the work changed them?
In a sense, it's expected that everyone's bodies will deteriorate over time doing farm work. It's expected that people will only be able to pick for a certain number of years before they have to do something else, either find a job tying the raspberry plants to the, you know, wooden structures or something where they're standing up more, or if their backs become painful enough, or their hips or their knees, then many of them go back to Mexico and convalesce, are taken care of by their extended family and their relatives back home in Mexico because they can't work anymore. One of the physicians who I quote in the book, talking a fair amount about this, the painfulness, the kind of pain of being a physician, watching all of your patients get sick and watching their bodies deteriorate over time. That physician no longer works in migrant health, partially for that reason. Since the book has come out, he's switched to a different kind of medical work because it was too hard, too painful, too sad to watch all of his farm worker patients develop all the sicknesses and injuries that are most common.
Our guest on Valley Edition today has been Dr. Seth Holmes. He's a medical anthropologist at UC Berkeley, and for 2 years he spent summers working with tricky farm workers in Washington State and here in Madera County. He later moved to Oaxaca in Mexico and lived with the farm workers there, all the while documenting the physical toll that this type of labor has taken on their bodies. His new book is called Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies, Migrant Farm Workers in the United States. He joined us today from KQED in San Francisco. Dr. Holmes, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much, Joe.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us. The address is talk@kvpr.org, and also send us a tweet @kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra Romero, and reporter Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.